you can't be grumpy anymore. So, you know, if it's permitted, and it's okay to be grumpy, then what's the problem? So, when people try to get rid of discontent, it just makes the discontent more. So don't try and get rid of discontentment. Embrace it, opening the door of your heart to your discontent. Oh, discontent, it's such a long time since you've come to visit me. Thank you for visiting. Really get into discontentment, like boredom. You know, boredom, do you really understand what boredom is? At a personal level, so many people get really, they haven't got a clue what boredom is. So the next time you are bored, investigate it. Really sort of, you know, get into it. Now, how does boredom feel in your body? Is it, where is it manifest in the body? What type of feeling is it in the body? How long does it last? You know, what else does it do to you? Does it mean you can't sleep properly, or you lose your appetite? Or what actually does boredom do to you? Does it make you not want to smile at other people, or not want to do the chanting? What actually is boredom? And don't just, you know, make a sort of superficial study. Get really into it. Because boredom is one of the most interesting subjects. In other words, boredom becomes interesting for you, and it's no longer boring. So it's using just obvious sort of psychology. But the root of that, treatment or therapy, if you like, that was a very well-known story, and I've seen it plagiarized in so many places these days. You know, because it works, other people quote it. And that was the anger-eating monster story. And I repeat that so many times because it's so powerful. So I'm going to mention it now in detail, and I'll probably have to refer to this many times in the retreat, either to do with meditation or your life. So, are you sitting comfortably? Once upon a time. You know, the best stories are the ones which even the kids can understand. Because, you know, they're just so powerful, so easy to understand, the children get it straight away. Once upon a time, there was an emperor. And the emperor, or the king, or whatever, the emperor went to the BGF one evening to listen to this incredible Dhamma talk. And while the emperor was at the BGF, into the palace came this really ugly, frightening, violent, terrifying monster. And no one could actually envisage or describe just the terror this monster put into people. Of course, because I don't watch movies, people say the most horrible monster was the alien. The alien monster. Is that true? But anyway, this monster made Alien look like a little pussycat. This was really violent and nasty and ugly and terrifying. So terrifying that all of these security and military guards and the people supposed to be guarding the palace, they got so scared they froze. They just, you know, hid under the table. They went behind the pillar, behind the into the broom cupboards, anywhere to hide from this monster. They were so scared. And that allowed the monster just to go right into the palace, right into the throne room, and sit on the emperor's chair. And that was one step too far. The security, the soldiers, the guards, even the ministers came out. You've gone too far, monster. Get out! Now! Is that convincing? Me being angry? No. I know. Sometimes they have like things called charm school. I want to find the opposite. The uncharm school, the anger school. No, anyway. Get out of here, you don't belong. And those few unkind words, unkind deeds, and unkind thoughts the monster grew and inch bigger. More ugly, more frightening, more terrifying. And that just made all the guards and the soldiers even more upset. We told you, get out now. You'll be in big trouble. Get out now. You can't do this. This is not your place. Get out now. And every unkind word, unkind deed, unkind thought, the monster just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And more violent, more and more frightening, and more stinky. And by the time the emperor came back, the king, this monster was huge, as big as half of this hall. It was surprising that, you know, that throne could hold him. And he was so angry and violent, even just one look at him just made you shiver. And the smell coming off his body was so gross. Even the maggots which were crawling on his skin, even they vomited. And when maggots can't stand the smell, they're really stinky. But when the emperor came in, the reason he was the emperor was because he was clever, he was smart. He took one look at the situation and straight away said, "Monster, thank you for coming to visit me. Why have you been absent for such a long time? Has anyone got you something to drink yet? We have tea tarik. Even Ajahn Brahm likes that. We have peppermint tea if you want some good health. We've got all carrot juice. We have soya milk. What would you like to drink? And what about something to eat? You know, would you like vegetarian? Or, you know, what about some McDonald's? I can send out whatever you want. And even pizza, because pizza, they have monster-sized pizza. From Pizza Hut. Anyway, you better take these advertisements out, because people will think that this talk has been sponsored by McDonald's and Pizza Hut. And what would you like? And it was sincere kindness. The emperor wasn't playing. He just really wanted to be kind to this monster. Did you feel so much compassion? Monsters, no one likes monsters. Imagine being reborn as a monster. Everyone is always afraid of you. No one likes you. You just know it's so, it may be horrible on the outside, but everyone's got this beautiful soft spot inside. So, never being respected at all, this monster, in his whole life. No one treated it with respect. And the emperor just really respected our monster. Anything I can get for you. And at that, the monster grew an inch smaller, less aggressive, less ugly, less smelly, less fearful. And that is when all the people understood their mistake. So they started being kind to the monster. They started giving compassion. May all beings be happy and well, including ugly, smelly monsters. And they were so kind that some of them gave him a foot massage. Now, first of all, imagine a monster's feet. They're huge. So it took about a dozen people, maybe even more than that, to give a foot massage to this monster. And I like foot massages every now and again, and sometimes you press, oh, just that, that's it, oh, yes. The monster was enjoying it, because no one ever had the kindness to give monsters foot massage before. And it was so rare and so wonderful that the kindness of the guards and the soldiers to give him the monster a foot massage, someone gave him a shoulder massage. Monsters have these huge heads. And so imagine the weight of that head. Have you ever had a neck ache? I mean, these monsters, their neck must really ache. So really gave them a nice massage, got some nice healing oil to massage it. I mean, I'm sure that you know more about this than I do with, like, you know, healthcare and just... So they're so nice that every kind act, kind word or kind thought, the monster kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And even before the monster-sized pizza came from the delivery boy, even before that, The monster had shrunk to the size when he first came in. And they kept on being kind and kind, welcoming the monster, until the monster got so tiny, one more act of kindness, one more smile, and the monster vanished completely away. And that is based on a story from the sutras. Loosely based. Because I added a lot. But the main point was, the Buddha said, we call those things anger-eating monsters. You give them anger, and they get bigger, smellier, more of a problem. You give them kindness, and they start to shrink. And even the discontent, anger-eating monster. So get out of here, you don't belong. Thoughts. I'm thinking, I don't want to think. There's another thought. Yeah, shut up, I don't want to think. That's getting angry. I'm not supposed to get angry, but I'm not really angry. I'm doing blah, blah, blah. The thoughts come. Thank you, thoughts, for coming to visit me. So, welcome, thoughts. So that way, when we welcome stuff, we welcome grumpiness. Then grumpiness shrinks and gets smaller and smaller and smaller the more you're kind to it. The Angry Eating Monster is a wonderful story on the psychology of negativity. Anyway, here we go. Thought. After an unpleasant experience, the emotion lingers in my head and body. How do I quickly change my emotional state? Why, even when we are aware of a thought that is tied to a certain event that we experience, it is too difficult to change our bodily reaction? So one thing is because, again, we just resist energy to it. So if you have an emotion come up, let it come. Already, a couple of people during the interviews have said that they have an emotion, sometimes they just want to cry. The tears want to come down. What's wrong with that? In the 8 precepts, is there any of those precepts which say, no, crying, I will refrain from crying? Of course not. The story which I usually tell was of this Australian man, who is in his maybe mid-30s, 40s, and when he came on one of my retreats, he started weeping. He didn't know why. So he came on to the interviews and he said, look, what's going on? I got all these emotions, I was crying, I don't know why, I'm having a good life. And then I asked him, when was the last time before this that you cried? And that's when he became silent. And then he told me, when he was about 10 or 11 years of age, as a boy in Australia, he cried for some reason or another, and his father told him, Australian men don't cry. And trying to live up to other people's expectations, especially his father's and his Australian friends, to be tough. Because of that, he had actually bottled up those emotions for such a long time. So that when he told me that, I replied, sir, you've got a lot of crying to catch up with. And he did. He cried and cried and cried throughout the retreat because he could, and he wasn't suppressed anymore. And I think he was a single guy, but he probably isn't now, because there were so many girls that looked at him and said, oh, are you okay? Can I look after you? So if any of you looking for a girlfriend or a partner-in-law start crying, it really gets to a part. It's a bit sneaky. But so if after I'm present, the emotion lingers in my head and body, you have to let it, not linger, but just focus on it. Allow it to be. Just allow it to come up, welcome it, and then it vanishes. We have to let it come in first of all. Don't suppress it. And then afterwards you learn it's nothing to be ashamed of. And you know, you have very unpleasant experiences. I have unpleasant experiences. But then I learn from them and welcome them. When you welcome them and learn from them, you can tell everybody about them. I already told about What did I tell about that? I told it in the BGF about the nurse in the hospital in Ubon, who I hated. I was supposed to be a monk, but I couldn't, because she would inject me in my bum twice a day. With his, I meant to stab, not inject, because they're really blunt needles. Oh, really hurt. But anyway, but you know, you have some difficult experiences in life, as we all do. We welcome them, because that's where we learn the most, from the difficulties. And if they're still lingering with you, it means you haven't really learned yet. There's still some lessons that experience is teaching you. But don't blame anybody and don't blame yourself. The blame is what causes the bad feelings. No one is perfect. You know, sometimes we make mistakes, we do. We think it's right at that time. We're in between a difficult situation, we do this, and sometimes it does hurt others. You've done the same. So sometimes when we have a bit more, bigger understanding and more tolerance and more forgiveness, it's easy to let go of the past. But that's one of the reasons why, to be able to let go of the past and let go of the future, be kind to the past. Be kind to the future. Today I was telling how when you have aches and pains in the body or tumors or stuff, sometimes we just are kind to that pain. And it gets less and less and less. It gets more and more kind until it just fades away. That's physical pain or physical injury. Now we're talking about emotional injury, emotional pain from the past. Be kind to it. May all my traumas and disappointments of the past be happy and well. And spread that beautiful kindness. And what it does, it softens them. It softens them so much that it just... so easy to let go of. If they're really hard and sharp and you have fists with them there and it is really causing you pain, you're getting angry at them. That's what hardens them. Having loving kindness towards them, then they shall disappear. So, loving kindness, open the door of your heart to them. You've got the door of your heart. Remember, things can come in. They stay a while, but they don't last. And then they go out again. The doorway is to come in and also to go out. So when you open the door of your heart, things leave as well. You mentioned in your book that nimitta is a reflection of the mind. Where is the mind? Okay, where is the mind? Are you happy now? Okay, let's say something else. That's a nice word. Have you ever fallen in love? When you fall in love, where is that love? Can you point to it? Is it in here? Or here? Or in here? Or here? I'm not going to point to any other places. When you fall in love, you can't locate it in space. You're so happy. When you're depressed, where is depression? Can you point it to in the body? Where actually is it? When you're at peace, where's peace? Where is it in the body? Is it in space? All these things, peace, happiness, love, anger, fear, all of these things, you can't point to them in space because they don't live in space. These are things of the mind. Food, I can point to where the food is, you know, up in the restaurant, or, you know, in the kitchen. That's what we call a kitchen or a restaurant, where the food is. Or you can talk, you know, where a monastery is. What's a monastery? It's where there's monks and nuns. That's why it's called a monastery. So by their content, that's where we can locate them. So all of those emotions, that's where the mind is. But it's not in space. And that's the words. The story of my good friend, I didn't actually see him this time in England, I usually do, but he was the consul of Macau for a little while, and so he spoke perfect Mandarin. And anyway, his, I forget, first or second daughter grade one at school, in the infant school, teacher asks the question, what's the biggest thing in the world? And one kid, my daddy, who said, 5 or 6 years of age, your daddy is a huge being in your life. An elephant is much bigger than her daddy. She'd just been to the zoo. No, a mountain is much bigger than elephants and daddies. And this is where the daughter of my friend, only 5 or 6 years of age, eventually she did a PhD in biochemistry in Oxford. Brilliant girl. But you know, she's signs of genius, very young. My eye is the biggest in the world, she said. What do you mean? No one understood what she meant. Only the teacher. What do you mean, your eye's the biggest in the world? Well, my eye can see her daddy. My eye can see an elephant. My eye can see a mountain. It can see so much more. If my eye can see all of that, if all of that can fit into my eye must be the biggest thing in the world. And that's actually what genius is. Seeing things from a different angle. And that answers so many questions. But when my friend told me that in a letter, I always said 9 out of 10 because your mind can see everything your eye will ever see and can imagine things you will never see. And your mind can hear sounds, real and imaginary. It can smell, it can taste, it can feel sensations of the body. Again, real and imaginary, no phantom limbs and stuff. And your mind has its own area of knowledge which the 5 senses will never be able to touch. In fact, everything you can ever know and experience and feel, everything can fit into your mind. That is why your mind is the biggest thing. I never said in the world, because the world can fit in your mind. That's why it's the biggest thing. And that's why we can't point to the mind. It's not in space. It's not in your body. If you could point to the mind, it's in your body somewhere, say it's in this region, then that would mean fear, love, anger can all be found in here where the mind is. It's much bigger than that. So that's what the mind is. And the reflection of the mind, this is how you experience the mind. That's why when nimittas come, they are almost like a stepping stone into the realm of the mind, which is not in space. It's not in just this physical space. It's not in rupa loka. It's beyond. That's why when I was a kid, I think one of the last TV series I watched was Star Trek. And they always said the Star Trek Enterprise with Captain Kirk. So they used to say to boldly go where no man has gone before. And I say to boldly go where no monk has gone before. Boldly. It's actually, you know, going to be amazing places. Anyway, dear Ajahn, sometimes when I do or make a decision, an image of someone, it can be a Buddha, a friend, etc., appeared in my mind. These incidents didn't just happen once or twice, but quite frequently. Can you please share with me your thoughts on my experience? Does this have any relationship with the third eye? No. Having 2 eyes is more than enough. So when I do or make a decision, depends what those decisions are. I'm sure if you make a decision what to eat for lunch, you don't get an image of a Buddha or a friend. But if it's really important decisions, sometimes it might just resonate with a decision you made some time ago. Or it might sort of, an image of a Buddha just might just give you a sense of, you know, the bigger picture of, you know, how that your decisions impact on life. So If an image comes of someone, a Buddha, a friend, etc., appear in your mind, it's probably just some way your mind is trying to help you make a good decision. But with decision making, you know, being a sort of a CEM, you know what CEM means? A chief executive monk. I have to make decisions. But there's one thing which I discovered. You can actually drive yourself crazy and have so much stress making a decision. You know, should I go to the BGF 30th anniversary, or should I go to the Ehi Pasiko tour to Indonesia, which is happening at the same time, I found out today. So what can I actually do? When I make decisions, I could I go really crazy. But usually what I do, I just make a decision. And once I made the decision, make it quickly and easily. And then afterwards is what I do next is where I save all my energy for. So once you've made a decision, then you make it work. You really give it everything you've got. Sometimes, by the time we make a decision, we're exhausted. So we've got nothing to give. So what I do usually is make sure that I make a decision quickly, see what happens, and then save all my energy. Right, now I'm going to make this work. Just like ordaining bhikkhunis. Make the decision, I'm going to make it work. Just stay for the course. So you have all the energy at the end. How different or how similar are the concepts of Nibbana and Hindu Brahman? Very different. If you want to know what union with God is, that is first jhana. Similar. Blissed out. You have vanished. The idea of a separate self and entity has gone. You can't do anything. Pure love. Blissed up to the eyeballs and beyond. And again, I mentioned this, that little story of Anita Murajani. Sort of when she went up, you know, after death into the light, she thought it was union with God. But the important point was so bliss, she wasn't there. Incredible love. Nothing wrong with you. You don't need to improve or to prove anything. You're totally accepted. So much peace and joy when you don't have to do anything. So that's typical of a first jhana experience. Blissed out of your head. Some people will experience this. So much love, I just disappeared. So much happiness and joy. Nibbana is something else. Go through that. More bliss. Different types, just like there are different flavors of ice cream. When you just get your first flavor, this is delicious, but then there's even more refined, more deep, more peaceful, till Nibbana. Gone. I like to be dramatic in talks. You know, one of the reasons I do this, and one of the reasons I just, really tried and liven up talks, because when I was a young student and in the Cambridge University Buddhist Society, we used to get all these monks and these experts giving talks, and I'd fall asleep. They were boring as hell. And I only went there because I'm a Buddhist and I like Buddhism, and these were famous people, but they never knew how to give a talk. So that's why, you just change the modulation of your talk, which gets people alive. You create eye contact, which is really important, because then when I create eye contact, I see some people, they've got their head down looking at their watch. I'm losing them. And a few little stories and jokes. When I sit with knowing and with joy and with enjoying the smoothest breath, another mind arises and says, are you sleeping? If it says, are you sleeping, you can't be asleep. Because you can't think when you're asleep. You're just maybe dreaming. But anyway, I'm very scared and try to make even more attention onto the breath. Oh, don't spoil it. To make sure that I'm clear with the breath instead of sleeping. sleeping is not against the eight precepts as well. If you need to sleep, sleep the first few days, you will sleep. You're catching up. And even it's much better. What was that story in the suttas? There was the Buddha with Venerable Ananda, his attendant, saw a monk. So just on the edge of the forest, he was sitting in full lotus, back straight, right hand over the left hand, thumbs touching, the chin chucked in, motionless, meditating. The perfect posture. And the Buddha turned to Ananda and said, I'm worried about that monk. And sure enough, a few weeks later, he disrobed. He went deep in the forest, and there he saw another monk sitting in the middle of the forest. Nodding this way, nodding that way. And the Buddha said, I'm not worried about him. And a few weeks later, he was perfectly enlightened with many psychic powers. So if you could relate to that, that's you, nodding this way, nodding that way. Just be patient, a couple of weeks. Fully enlightened with psychic powers. And of course, when I first read that, it was, well, what's going on here? And the Buddha did explain it, that the one on the edge of the forest was just too close to sensuality. He hadn't renounced enough. But not just renounced, you know, being close to people, but not renouncing control. He was a control freak monk. And I got to know one of those. This monk, he was a French monk. When he disrobed, he actually gave me his bowl, which I've still got. Oh, 41 years ago. And he would hardly speak to anybody. He kept his noble silence so well. And whenever he'd meditate, we'd do meditations all night, once a week. And I'd be nodding all over the place. And he was always straight back. You'd never see him nod, not once. And we all, you know, talking amongst ourselves, you know, just gossiping. You know, the monk said, oh, no, he must be so close to enlightenment. You know, really deep meditation. Never see him nodding. He's just so tranquil all the time. And then he disrobed. And it was a shock to us. And so I asked him, I thought your meditation was so much better than mine. He said, Ajahn Brahm, I was so afraid to fall asleep. I was just trying to be the ideal monk, and that just made me so tight and tense inside. He said, sometimes I'd open my eyes, he would say to me, and I saw you nodding. And I thought, I wish I could do that. To be able to let go and just, you know, be natural and not be afraid of what other people think of me. And that's what he was. He was so trying to live up to the ideal of a monk. He was afraid. And I felt so sad. I wish he'd have told me something and I could try and ask him to just relax a bit more. But he was so tense and tight and afraid. He lasted 3 years. That was an amazing achievement. But all that tightness and tension, no joy, must have been just terrible torture. So that was what I saw in talking to people. So that's, you know, how that Buddha saw it as well. That to be natural, to let go, to relax. The tiredness goes quite easily. You just start to, if you fight it, you're just wearing out more energy. So just relax, go to bed. You know, if you're tired here, you get it wrong. Just allow your body to drip. It will straighten up by itself when it's ready. It's not yours. It's not me, not mine, not a self. So just leave it alone. Let it go. And that's the wonderful thing which happens. You're really tired, your head is down here, and then it straightens up by itself. If you've ever experienced that, it's not me. I never told it to straighten up. It just did it. And the mind clears and becomes very bright and very powerful. And that's the way to meditate. So don't be a control freak. This one over here. It is. I think I did. Just fold it up. So. Okay. How do we ordain as a monk in Bodhinyana Monastery? Thanks. So somebody wants to become a monk. You know that. No, I'm serious here, that it sometimes disappoints me. I feel sad that I can't make enough opportunities to ordain people as monks and nuns as well. It's why I sacrifice everything to become, you know, to make an opportunity for nuns to ordain. But whenever you build a monastery, it gets full. And that's, even nuns' monastery is full, the monks' monastery is full. I mean, it's really full, the monks' monastery. So the last rains retreat, it was just, I didn't know where to put them all. And so because of that, that's why I said it's, you know, on the trying to build more monasteries. It's the only way we can do it. Bodhinyana Monastery is chock-a-block. Nuns' Monastery is pretty full. So I'm spending a lot of my time just raising funds to make monasteries. So whoever wrote that could ordain. Some of you might come along and you might at least have a try, see what it's like. And most people, they try, oh no, it's not really for me. But at least they try, and there's the opportunity there. So, and it hurts me. That's one of the things which is a pain for me. When good people, they can't find a decent place to ordain and live the holy life. It's almost as if, you know, it's my duty and job, and sometimes I fail you. Because you want to become a monk, and really good people, you do wonderful, but it's not a good place for you. So I'm just, you know, opening up and being honest with you, trying my best. And other monks, Ajahn Brahmali, trying his best. You know, we do lots of building work. Sometimes Australian government doesn't really understand. They put all these obstacles like fire prevention strategies and stuff. And I just, look, you know, we're monks. We don't mind if we die. You know, we're not going to sort of, you know, sue you because you allowed us to build huts in a forest. And we're not going to, many people die in bushfires because they run back for their personal possessions. And we don't have personal possessions. We're not going to run back because our teddy bear is just really nice. And then teddy bears can fry, we can get another one. So sometimes it's really hard to explaining what a monk is, what a nun is. So anyway, we'll get there. So, as one person said, that, you know, if you really do have the karma for it, then things open up and it happens. You know, one monk decides to go off to another monastery and there's an opening or something. Anyway, how would I know if I am meditating and not merely closing my eyes, at times seeing some bright light and could hear the sound surrounding me? If I were to hear sound and perhaps see some images, both people I know or unknown pictures, what does this mean? You notice when I was meditating just a few minutes, you know, before the talk, I saw this amazing limiter in my eye. And over my eye, and over. I knew it was your flashlight. But most of the time, give yourself benefit of the doubt. If you think it's an limiter, just say it is. And just hear what happens next. Yes, you can still hear surrounding sounds and feel some of the body, but if it really is an imitator coming up, it eventually becomes so strong it dominates the other five senses. So you can't really feel the other five senses, and the imitator is the one which takes over. I will obviously say more about imitators in one of the morning talks as we proceed. Dearest Ajahn, the dearest? I'm not that expensive, otherwise I'll be sold in Gucci, not Gucci, what's the other place? Louis Vuitton. That's very, very expensive, isn't it? Yeah. But maybe I am dearest because I only go to the very elite Buddhist societies like the BGF. You don't see me in cut-rate Buddhist societies. Would like advice, how can one reduce the habit of having body gestures? E.g. before walking, need to touch knees or toes. Also need to have some touching of knees, etc. with mega metta. I don't see anything. As long as it's your knees and no one, not somebody else's knees. Otherwise you get in big trouble these days. So if you need to gestures, just every now and again, just try to do it differently. But it's not a big deal, touching. So I would just, the habit of having body gestures. Before walking, need to touch knees or toes. Seated, also need to have some touching of knees, etc. Just, I don't know why you do that, but there's nothing wrong with that. We all have a little strange habits, like I tell stupid jokes. Sometimes when I do something or make decisions, the image picture, oh, this is interesting, almost the same as the other one. The image of picture of the person whom could be a Buddha, oh, this is the same one. Unless it's synchronicity. Ooh. Now, actually, that when I was teaching in England, there were so many questions, there's no way that I could answer them all. Do you know what people did? They put the same question in 3 or 4 times to give more chance of it being picked out of the box. Just like if you buy more lottery tickets, the more chance there is of winning. How is sleeping and meditation different? Both makes people calm and utterly lose the 5 senses. Please guide me. The difference is, in meditation, you're aware that you're peaceful. And the energy is huge. In sleeping, it's very, very low energy state. And in sleeping, yeah, you just half relax your body, but you're tossing and turning all the time. In meditation, you're perfectly still for such a long time. I think there was, on these videos, that we once videoed a monk, actually without his permission, and we videoed him for an hour, and then actually put it on fast forward, as fast as we could possibly do. Because when you put things on fast forward, you know, you can actually see any sort of jerks, they really stand out. But this monk, when we videoed him, it was the same as if it was going on ordinary speed. That was really impressive, because he was so peaceful and still that there's no movement at all. And so that's the difference between sleep. Sleep, you're tossing and turning. When you're meditating, you're perfectly still, even bodily. So you get a far deeper rest of the body. And that's also why, if any of you do get into a very deep state of meditation, a very strong nimitta, or even better, a jhana, if you get that this evening after my talk, you will not be able to sleep tonight. You don't want to sleep. You're just full of energy, blissed out, having a wonderful time. Who wants to sleep when you're having so much fun? That's the side. You've got powerful energy coming up. So that's the other way you know it's very good meditation, because of the energy which you're left with afterwards. It's much better than sleep. If you do have a good meditation like that, you can lay in your bed to relax the body, but you know, you'll never fall asleep. What does sadhu means? It means, the best English translation is awesome. Awesome. I'm sure there's a local word which is, you know, pretty much the same. But that's what sadhu means. Is there a minimum duration to have a good sitting? Yes. 1 second is the minimum. It's much better to do 1 second of meditation than no second at all. Now, that's actually adapted from what Ajahn Chah used to say. If you can't meditate for an hour, half an hour. Half an hour is you can't fit it in, do 15 minutes. That's better than nothing at all. 10 minutes is better than nothing. So if you can't do 15, do 10. If you can't do 10, do 5. If you can't do 5 minutes, do 1 minute. If you can't do 1 minute, it's pretty awful. So to anticipate a similar question, when is the best time to meditate? When is the worst time to meditate? The best time to meditate is now. The worst time to meditate is later. During my meditation, my breath becomes very soft and bright light started appearing from the corner of my eye. Instead of being like a full moon, it's more like a bright light encapsulating me. Is this the vision you are talking about in your book? What should I do or not do? You just let it develop. In other words, things are happening. Don't spoil it. Just let it see how it develops. The type of light, its brilliance, what it does. So, this is a time where you can imagine that you are meditating and I'm a little dog sitting next to you, if you do anything. Just like the story of the pilot and the dog in the cockpit. So don't do anything, it's working. For doing something, it means you're trying to achieve something in the future, you've lost the present moment. All doing, wanting, craving, aspirations always needs a future for your wanting to land in. But if you don't have any perception of a future or past, wanting just can't land anywhere. It's got no purpose. It fades away. So for present moment awareness, got a beautiful light, just leave it alone. See what happens. But don't aim for anything. Take away your perception of the future. You've only got the present. And then just the mind will evolve by itself. It's really a shame sometimes that people get to these beautiful stages, lights start to happen, and they forget the instructions. Just like the old monks don't lie. Why don't you get jhanas and enlightenment? The Buddha was the oldest monk. He doesn't lie. So if he said he could do something like Satipatthana in 7 days, at least be a non-returner. Doesn't lie. Why isn't it working? Because you don't follow the instructions. So follow the instructions. Just sit there, do nothing, see what happens. Thank you very much for the talk on meditation this morning. Can you please give a talk on how to do walking meditation also? Yep. With walking meditation, it's pretty similar. So, as I mentioned, when that Swedish professor asked Ajahn Chah, how do you meditate? He said, how do you eat? So, did anyone ever teach you how to walk? Maybe your mum or dad, so you just walk. You don't make it complicated. So, when you are walking, when you're not trying to get anywhere or do anything, and stop all this thinking business, you become aware of your feet. So first of all, just get peaceful, relax, just walk. It's much easier when you have no destination. So that's why we walk, find a nice passage, walk to the end, turn around and walk back again. So that makes life very simple. You're not getting anywhere. That's the wonderful thing about walking meditation. You don't get anywhere. You're not going places. You turn around and you go back again. You end up where you started. That is very deep and profound. And it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. How you're walking, not where you're getting to. So, you start and run in, just one or two backwards and forwards just to get yourself comfortable. Then put your attention a couple of meters in front of you. Maybe a body length in front of you. And the eyes open, not to the left, not to the right. Just so you don't step on anything. And so you can see the wall before the wall comes and hits you. And turn around. So just a couple of meters. People ask, should I just close my eyes when I do walking meditation? I don't think we've got insurance for that in the BGF, have we, for physical injuries? So anyway, that we just keep our eyes open. We walk. And then we become aware of our legs. Which leg is moving? Left leg, right leg. And where do you know the movement called walking? Do you have to watch it at the tip of the nose, or at the belly, or at the feet, or at the knees? Don't make it complicated. You know that the left foot is moving. You know the right foot is moving. Simple. So you know you're walking left, right. And then quite naturally, as you keep walking, your mindfulness, keep it simple. Don't go thinking about stuff, but feel the sensations. That's why it's really good to take your socks off and your shoes off when you're walking, so you can feel the texture of the tiles or whatever else you're walking on your feet. You can feel them. What's it like for me to touch that carpet with the hard wood, I imagine, underneath it? You get very sensitive. I'm going to put the thing on my feet now. You know, when I was in Korea once, we did a meditation master's walk. And Ajahn Gunha was there, but, you know, he wasn't so well enough to go on this walk. And this was in the snow. It was minus 16 degrees outside in the snow fields. And I had just my same Birkenstocks, which I have over there, no socks, because I don't like socks. And I was walking just with sandals, but no socks. And the other monk, when we got to the end, we had to put our handprint in the end to prove that we'd actually been there and done this walk. I suppose it was some sort of tourist attraction. And the other monk with me from the Jogche order, when he put his handprint on, I realized he only had three fingers. And the reason was to show just how tough and powerful he was. He put one finger in the candle flame until it burnt off. And if that wasn't enough, he did a second finger as well. That's why he became really famous. So he was a man so tough that, you know, he could only have three fingers left. But they had TV cameras, and they weren't focused on his fingers. They were focused on my feet. These Australian monks are so tough. They can walk in the snow without socks. It was really weird. I was just walking, and they had all these TV cameras on my feet. It's ridiculous. There's no psychic powers. Just I've got good circulation, that's all. And I'd much prefer to actually take my socks off in the snow than put my fingers in front of a candle flame. Anyway, just you reminded me of that when you pointed that at my feet. But anyway, so when you're doing walking meditation, you actually feel, just first of all, you know, which foot is moving. And then you get full awareness of the walking. What part of your foot leaves the ground first? What's the last part of your, say, right foot, which breaks contact with the ground? And how does it move up? Does it move up just totally vertical? Or does it go to the side or to the back? Be aware of just how many movements in your leg is required just to lift your foot up. And once it's up, then what happens? You've got to move it forward. To move it forward, is it straight, or is it a circle, an arc, curve? And then when you get to that point, how does it go down? And what's the first part of your foot meets the ground, and the last part which meets the ground? And actually, once it's met the ground, you can actually feel the body move for your weight to be transferred from the left foot now to the right foot, freeing the left leg to start moving. You're actually so aware, and it's fascinating, it's so joyful. Actually, all these amazing thousands of different movements just for one step. So that's how you do walking meditation. Don't try and do it slow or do it fast. Do it natural. Because don't think you always have to do walking meditation slowly. Because it happened at Jhana Grove that it's an Australian family. They were very good Buddhists, and they brought their kids, and they said, "Oh, can we look at your retreat center?" I said, "Yeah, sure, but there's a retreat on there, so just be very quiet and don't disturb them." And so they went over there, and half an hour later they came back. Actually, less than that, about 15 minutes later they came back, and their child, maybe 9 or 10 years of age, was really upset. That's why they came back. "I had to talk to you now." "What's wrong?" "Your retreat center, right now, it's been invaded by zombies." Because apparently a few years ago they had all these zombie movies. They used to have vampire movies, zombie movies, or whatever, I don't know. But the zombies always walk really slowly. And this little kid, he just went there, stop bees, do something now. And that's his face. They're not zombies, they're yogis. They're doing meditation. He says, not much difference. But anyway, that was funny. So just do it at a natural pace. It gets slow anyway because there's so much stuff going on, you don't want to disturb it. But do it naturally. But anyway, more questions on walking meditation come later on. There are many meditation techniques with mantras, visualization, etc. Would you say that they are equally effective? The object of meditation is not important, but the attitude you have to meditation is really crucial. Are you meditate to make peace, to let go, to renounce? Or are you meditating to get something? Are you meditating to increase your personal best? In walking meditation, sometimes we do walking meditation parallel to one another. And sometimes there's a competition, who can walk slowest? Well, I've done this myself, been on retreats, and I've been sitting on, I'm going to be the last person who leaves the hall. And I close my eyes. Okay, last person. I open my eyes. Damn it, he's still here. Who does he think he is? And I close my eyes and I hear something rustle and I open my eyes. He's just changing his posture. He's still here. That is so stupid. I'm sure you've come across that. There's nothing to do with meditation. If you meditate just to make peace, to be kind, to be gentle, no matter what object you have, if it's to make peace with it, to be kind to it, to be gentle, then it works. To control it, to own it, just cause problems to you. To get angry, try and get rid of things, cure things, develop things, to make it work, no. Don't cure your defilements. Care for them. Then they disappear. As a beginner, how do I know if I'm meditating or sleeping? Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. And if you're going to do it properly. If you're going to sleep, that's what the beds are there for. So these cushions over here, they're not really made for sleeping. They're very uncomfortable to sleep. Especially if you start snoring and you disturb it. Well, imagine if somebody else was snoring when the Buddha was under the Bodhi tree. It wouldn't be a Buddha. So, if you're tired, take a rest. This is not being soft. This is being wise. I've been teaching this for a long time. You get far more people into some deep meditation, great insights, happiness, when you're kind, and when you force things. Dear Ajahn, destiny, fate, or free will? You mentioned in your talk, there is no total free will. If I understand you correctly, if we have no total free will, then our life is also substantially fated. You know, I knew you had to ask that question. No, I've known you making up. Free will, fated. You know, for a monk, sometimes people ask you, well, make donations to all your projects, but can we offer something personal to you? You've really helped me. Is there anything you need, Ajahn Brahm? Just for you. Not for your temple, they get enough, but for you. What can I get you? So, when it was my birthday once, somebody really wanted to do something special for my birthday. I'd really help them because, you know, their son passed away in tragic circumstances. And I really sort of helped them. So, please, Ajahn Brahm. So, what they did, actually they tricked me. They knew it was my birthday. They said, oh, just by the way, what time of day were you born? And once I told them, they made my horoscope. Not a cheap one from the newspapers. A professional, whatever you call it, horoscopologist or whatever it is. What's it called? Oh, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Not astrology. Astrologist. Whatever. Anyway. Yeah, anyway. A professional. It cost them quite a lot of money to get all of the planets sort of, you know, where they were when I was born and how they all worked out. And this was a person who was really famous and very, very expensive to get my horoscope for that year. And at my birthday, he presented it to me. Ajahn Brahm, this is my gift to you on your birthday, your horoscope for the next year. And he actually read out the first paragraphs for me. And so I say, this was very expensive. This person who did it was very well known. And he started reading out for Ajahn Brahm, born on the 7th of August 1951 at a certain time. This year will be a very good year for romance. I cracked up, all the monks cracked up, all the people listening burst out laughing. And he was wrong. I'm still a monk. So, free will, destiny, can you tell what's going to happen? Anyway, we come out, I always like procrastinating. Free will and stuff, that's deep meditation stuff, so we'll do that later on. Never do tonight what you can pull off until another day. so you avoid getting into trouble. You mentioned about letting go in Buddhism. Values such as kindness, compassion are highly regarded. Yet how do you draw a line taking action against a person who bullied, belittled or humiliated you? My experience suggests that if my inaction resulted in my disadvantage or losses. It's sometimes letting go does not necessarily mean being inactive. Sometimes there's a times when you should never let go. There's times when you should be attached. Like when you're on the back of a motorcycle traveling through KL. Hang on. Grasp. Don't let go. But, so really, kindness, compassion is letting go. Letting go of what you want for others. Letting go of me. It's not me, not mine, we're in it together. So, but when people take advantage of you, remember that story I wrote, and it's based on a story in the Jataka's, the story of the bad snake. The really bad, it's nice in the evening to tell stories. You've had enough deep dharma already. Because, you know, a deep dharma like free will, you forget it by the morning. So anyway, the bad snake. Once upon a time, was this really mean and nasty and malicious snake. He lived by the side of the road, and sometimes he'd hide in the grass, and he'd bite people just for fun. They weren't harming him or challenging him. Most snakes, you know, they're more scared of you than you are of them. They would never bite you unless you harass them. But this snake was different. He just really enjoyed biting people and making them really sick, or even killing them. He was one mean, bad snake. And he lived like that most of his life. You know, the snakes, they talk to one another. I don't know what they're saying. It's all the same hiss to me, but they talk to one another. They can communicate. And now he met, you know, with some of his old friends from many, many years. And they started talking to him about religion. What happens to snakes after they die? And now, yeah, it's a lot of rubbish. Religion, all they want is your donations. They don't really, really know what's going on. Now, how do they know what happens when you die? They're all alive still. So he always just poured scorn on all religions. But when he started getting old, he started to really wonder, I'm going to die. I've seen some of my friends die. What happens to me when I die? And he did hear that not far from his hole where he would live and go out to bite people from, not far away, that was his job, his business, and not far away, on top of a hill, was a holy snake. He was so well regarded as a great meditator, very wise, sometimes funny, living a very simple life. Now, he looked like he had a good reputation. So one day, the bad snake decided to pay him a visit. But he was so sort of proud. And how can you deal with people just having said so terrible things about religion all his life? What if someone would recognize him there? He'd be humiliated. So he got a hat, you know, a big baseball cap, and a false beard, and big sunglasses to hide himself, and a big coat, like a raincoat, to go incognito. And so he slithered up, and as he went up to the top of the hill where the holy snake lived, he saw there was a big gathering of so many, about 150 other snakes, sitting on little cushions, and even one snake at the front had a little camera. But he didn't come to the front. He just was by the door. Behind the pillar so you couldn't see him. Because he didn't want to be seen. You know, just in case people found out that, you know, all their life he was just being a hypocrite. Because he was listening. And the more he listened, the more he became interested. It started to make sense. And after it started to make sense, he started to become inspired. And by the end of the talk, that bad snake had been converted. So he took off all of his disguise, and people were so surprised to see, wow, such a well-known bad snake had actually come to listen to a talk. And they were always, whoa, this is amazing. Then he came right up to the holy snake and asked for the three refuges and the five precepts. So inspiring. And he told the holy snake, I've lived a very, very bad life. I've been a very bad snake. I didn't really know what I was doing, but please I ask forgiveness from the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And so he was given forgiveness and was given the five precepts. And he, as he went out, he put a donation in the box. Coins, so everyone could hear. And asked for a receipt. And he went back to the hole where he lived. And he was, from that time on, he wasn't going to bite any more human beings. And he would spend the days sitting cross-coiled in deep meditation outside with a big holy smile on his face. And so, but people didn't know that he had changed. So they saw him, they'd run away, make a big detour. Even though, as I said in the story I wrote, he managed to get a couple of badges. Amnesty International was on one. World Wildlife Fund and that. So, and they didn't realize he was even a vegetarian too, this bad snake. But one day, this kid was walking past, you know, SMSing somebody on his iPhone. He almost stepped on a snake. He forgot, you know, this was a dangerous area, and he looked, and the snake just was smiling peacefully at this boy. That was the first sign this snake was not going to bite anybody anymore. So the people stopped trying to avoid him and walked right past him. But then one day, you know, in any sort of village community, there's always some really naughty people, you know, young boys, really scallywags. And so they decided to tease the snake. They say, you're not really a snake, you're just an oversized worm. You're just a creep. Show us your fangs if you've got any. You haven't got any, have you? And they were teasing him. And he was a very proud snake. You know, he's lived a very, you know, powerful life. But he had to take that abuse, verbal abuse. And then they started throwing things at him. Because they thought he was a coward. He wouldn't respond. And some of those things hit him. And they hurt. And he thought, I could just bite one of them, to show them what a real snake I am. But because of his vow of keeping the precepts, You couldn't buy anyone. And so the kids got sticks. They were still afraid. And that long sticks, they could beat him on the back. And that poor snake could not defend himself. He took that beating. And at the end of that beating, he realized in the real world, there's some really bad people out there, so you can't keep five precepts in the real world. So it's okay for monks, they live in a nice place, surrounded with really kind, good people, but out there in the big bad world, you have to be mean to survive. So he crawled up, painfully up, to see the holy snake, to get released from his five precepts. And when he was crawling up, the holy snake saw him and said, "What has happened to you?" And the bad snake said, "Your fault." "What do you mean it's my fault? Look, I keep the five precepts. That's what happened to me. I can't defend myself." And the holy snake, "Oh, you stupid snake, you dumb snake. What are you talking about?" And the holy snake, "It's true. I told you not to bite. But I never told you not to hiss. Because that's all a snake needs to do. Hiss!" And people will run away. "So you don't need to bite. Hissing is okay." You know, I did that once. I'm telling stories, but people don't mind. That I was, years and years ago, visiting England. I was staying with my mum. And she was cooking my lunch, which is very important for a young monk. So when the doorbell rang of her apartment, I said, "I'll answer it, Mum, so you don't spoil my lunch. It's my one meal of the day. So if you spoil it, I'm in big trouble for the rest of the day." So I answered the door, and there was this person outside. And if you have been in England, it was like a Romany. They called them a gypsy. And they were just making some money by begging door to door, selling little bits, little trinkets. And so, you know, she asked me, said, "Would you like to buy a gypsy trinket for good luck?" I said, "No, thank you." I was very polite. But then she said to me, "If you don't buy this trinket, I will put a gypsy curse on you." And that was their marketing campaign. And I was in my robes, and I stood up to full height, and I said, "I am a Buddhist monk. My curses are more powerful than yours." Now, I should not have said that, but I'm glad I did. Because that woman, her face went white, she turned around, she ran. She ran away. I really scared her. Of course, I would never curse anybody. Maybe. No, of course I'd never curse anybody, but she was trying to mess around with me. I don't mess around with her. So that was my hissing to teach her. That's not a way to sort of get any sales, by making people afraid. If you don't buy this, then something terrible is going to happen to you. So, it's okay to hiss sometime. Oh, I had fun with that. So I shouldn't have, but maybe a bad part of my character. When I meditate, I usually find a pillar, wall, cupboard to lean against to prop my body up. Am I not balancing my body correctly? No, that's fine. 80% of the participants can get upright by themselves, and they suffer sometimes. Why not me? What do I need to do? Nothing. That's fine. It's good enough. You find a cupboard, but you have to get there early to grab your cupboard, because somebody else will get it if you don't get there first. So, no, that's fine to do that. Don't worry about that. As long as you get peaceful, it's no problem. Please elaborate. Correct feeling if we are doing the walking meditation correctly. I think I mentioned that already. Also known as effortlessly, not wobbling. Transfer weight between two feet. Thank you. Sometimes people do walking meditation. I remember doing this. And you're walking backwards and forwards, being very peaceful, very still, just watching your feet. And then you realize you're not doing the walking. It's all automatic. Just, you know, the legs do the walking. Similar to in the old days when soldiers would go from place to place by marching all night sometimes, instead of going in trucks or lorries, that they would be marching all night, and psychologists would actually see them falling asleep. They were fast asleep, but they were still walking with all the other soldiers. The walking became automatic. Much of what your body does is automatic, just like your heart beats and all of the your lungs. You don't decide, I'm going to breathe now. Most of the time it does it automatically by itself. Just lubricating your eyes, it happens automatically. But some things which you think you're always in control of, when your body just starts walking, and you're just watching it, and I never tell it what to do, it just gets in a routine. When you're doing long walking for maybe an hour or so, and then you're just walking. It's really cool. What is the relation of jhana and sainthood? Thank you. Ah, this is one of the things I say, it's just really unfair being a Buddhist. Because if you were, say, a Christian and you got into the first jhana, they would call it union with God. And they would make you a saint. It would be, instead of Saint Andrew's Cathedral, it would be Saint Victor Wee's Cathedral. Because that's what happens. It's powerful. And you have amazing things happen to you afterwards. Miraculous things. But when we do meditation, we don't make it personal. You get into a jhana, we usually can't tell people what we've done. Being a saint is just more fuel for the ego. More fuel for conceit. I'm a saint. You're not. I'm closer to God than you are. Na, 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 na. That's also why, you know, if you do get any deep meditation, don't go telling your friends. If you get stages of enlightenment, don't tell anybody. It's amazing, it creates jealousy and envy more than anything else. So just keep it to yourself. It's not a personal attainment, it's a state of disappearing. So, states of letting go. So, if you do become enlightened, there's no place on you to pin a medal. There's nothing there. So, giving a certificate, now who's attained anything? There's no one there. So is it your first component of existence, body, becomes enlightened? Perception becomes enlightened? That just comes and goes. If perception becomes enlightened, sometimes it's enlightened, sometimes it ain't. Because it changes, anicca. Is it your experience, vedana, becomes enlightened? Is it your will becomes enlightened? The will becomes enlightened. Consciousness is. There's six of them. Which one is it? They're all totally different. So when you actually understand what's going on, you just vanish, you disappear. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not a person who enters it. It's very nice. If meditation is to achieve letting go and relax, would I achieve the same impact by having a good sleep? No. But having a good sleep might just be a good preparation. So that afterwards you get up in the morning and you get very peaceful. You're letting go but with full awareness and powerful mind. Could you please kindly explain at which point we should start watching the breath under the guided meditation? This morning when I was following the guided meditation, at one point I was in a state of stillness, I think, but when I realized that, it went away. Is stillness a state where it is totally peaceful, or aka feels like in a vacuum? Is when you just experiment. So on giving a guided meditation, you start becoming peaceful. If the breath comes up to you, then see what happens. You can follow it. And just, you know, we used to do a type of loving-kindness meditation in Pali, but I could never ever finish it. when we did the chanting all together. I got to the point of spreading loving kindness up to the east, the west, the north, the south, in all directions, and I got so inspired. I was just enjoying myself. I was flying. And so I stopped chanting because you didn't need it. The chanting had done its work. It just really got you into what loving kindness was. And just it spread everywhere. I didn't need to do anything. So I just couldn't open my mouth anymore. So when it happens, just let go and go with it. Feel like a vacuum? Not really a vacuum. Vacuum is, you can't live in a vacuum. Actually, vacuum might be good because you can't speak in a vacuum. Wouldn't it be nice if we lived in a vacuum? Then all this word and chatter, no one will be able to hear it. Hee hee hee. How to let go of control while we're watching the breath? I feel I am breathing controlling. If you are controlling when you're watching the breath gets disturbing. It's not natural. The usual example, now can you please be aware of the saliva in your throat? Now it's uncomfortable. Now I've got to swallow my saliva. That's not enough, now I've got to swallow it again. If you have trouble with the saliva in your throat, one option is to borrow one of those devices from the dentist. But when you don't even think about it, when you don't put awareness on it, the saliva just goes naturally. Why is it that when you put awareness on something, it starts to become disturbing? Because whatever you're aware of, you tend to control. Sometimes you go to somebody else's house. What's the wrong colour curtains on that? It's not your house, but you always interfere. Or somebody is driving you to the airport. And because I don't know the way to the airport, I'm a very good passenger. But someone's in the back, well, that's not the fastest way. I know a better way. They interfere. They're controlling. So it's much better just to sit there and just relax. And then the breath is natural. Just like it is when you're not focusing on it. Then it's very peaceful that way. So little by little, we learn how to watch the breath without controlling it. And it's very nice. Dear committee member. I'm not committee member. May I ask, where would the recording of Ajahn Brahm's talk during the retreat be uploaded? They are uploaded in your mind. Thank you, my email, so I'll give it to a committee member afterwards. You're doing it. It's live, but where is it going? Where they can in YouTube. BGF YouTube. Any advertisements? Advertisements for McDonald's and for the Pizza Hut. Ajahn Brahm, may I know how many months a fetus in a mother's womb do they start to feel? And if there are any arahats in this world currently? Totally different questions. Which one would you prefer to answer first? How many months a fetus in a mother's womb before they start to feel? This is the argument about abortions. When is actually killing? Killing a human being. Because the Buddha did say that human life starts when consciousness first manifests. In other words, that the fetus does start to show a reaction to pain, to pleasure, while it's still in the mother's womb. I've never really got a straight answer from that, but I did hear that one person say, please do not trust the books from the US. They say deliberately they were printed by a right to life people. And, you know, because it's a huge argument in the United States, and sometimes that they feel that the end justifies the means. And they say they have pictures in some of those books. They say a fetus after 3 months, 4 months, and they actually haven't got the time wrong. They did it on purpose. So I don't know why, but sometimes I'm not sure. But that's actually where you are killing a human being. But before then, if the fetus has got no reaction to pain and pleasure, the Buddha doesn't call that killing a human being. Are there any arahats in this world currently? The arahats would be not discernible. Are there any ghosts in this world? Devas? Spirits? Are there any arahats in this world currently? Quite likely. Almost certainly. Does that help? Well, that's committee number one. It's 2 more minutes to go. In your Happy Every Day book, page 187, oh my goodness. I'm in trouble now. What have I said? Okay. Quoted, you will make a better choice when you feel instead of think. My question is there any guideline for this follow your heart instead of follow your mind? Is someone fall in love with a married opposite sex? Should he or she follow their heart or should they follow their mind instead? It's an obvious one. If you fall in love with a married man or married woman, you will find that that's a doomed relationship. So, you are following what you feel instead of what you think. The feeling is you know that something's going wrong. It shouldn't be done. Follow your heart. Sometimes when I say follow your gut feeling, you should never follow your gut feeling when you've got indigestion. But following, you know, your feeling. And what was it? I do some very interesting things as a monk. I say to boldly go where no monk has gone before. I received an invitation while I was in Perth from a friend. He was a radio producer. He said that we do so many talk shows. We never had you on a talk show yet. So, you know, can you come on a talk show? I said, okay. Late on a Friday, after I'd done my Friday night talk at Nolamara, then I can come to the studios. I said, okay. And so I turned up at the studios really just, you know, late. But I managed to get into the studio just as the red lights, you know, that were on air, just came on. And I'd been in there before, so I needed to, you know, to put the headphones on quietly and just to have my mouth that far away from the microphone. And so then the host of the show started introducing people. Tonight we're very lucky to have on our show, he actually couldn't understand how to say Ajahn Brahm, so we agreed, honestly, that we agreed to call me Mr. Monk. Mr. Monk, a well-known Buddhist monk. And we also have Professor, that's what I remember her name now, Gabriel Morrissey, who's written many best-selling books on sexual problems in marriage. And that's what I, oh no, what show am I on? Friday evening, 10 p.m. to midnight. And it was on adult themes. You know, relationships, sex, and all sorts of weird stuff. Too late to escape now. But one of the questions which came up, which is the reason why I'm telling this, was a question from a taxi driver, anonymous, because taxi drivers were up late at night. And this is what he said. He said, I'm having an affair with another woman. My wife doesn't know. Is it okay? That's what he said. And I replied, sir, if it was okay, you would never be taking the trouble to call me to ask. What you wanted was someone to tell you it was okay because you know it's not right. He hung up straight away. So I got him just in one shot. That's what he was up to. He rings up experts to try and convince him that what he feels in his heart that is wrong is right. He would keep on asking and asking and asking until he got someone to tell him that it was okay. Then he'd be satisfied, he wouldn't ring up anymore. But I wasn't going to do that. It was wrong. He knew it was wrong. So when I said that it was wrong, that he hung up. He didn't like my answer. So, if you really follow your feeling, you know it's hurting someone. You just can't do it. The more, please excuse me, but the more mindful you are, the more you know how human beings work, the more you know what kindness is, you just can't hurt people. It just can't be done. That sort of feeling, it's not like monks keep precepts just to be goody-goodies. You can't break the precepts. Sometimes you say, Ajahn Brahm, you should be more fierce. Some of your monks take advantage of you. You should shout them. I just can't do that. So you can't hit anybody. You know, if I did join this entrance and they gave me a sense that you just can't do it. There's something inside you, your inner feelings. It's just impossible. So anyway, just one last question. Because you always tell me one last photograph. So this is me getting my own back. One last question, even though it's past time. I'm stretching your legs. I heard you talk about Buddha praising a monk who slouched over and seemed sleepy when meditating, while another monk sat with a very straight posture, and a Buddha was worried about that monk. Which sutta was that in, please? Thank you. Oh, no, it's in... Actually, I don't know exactly where it's in, but it's in one of the suttas. I'll see if I can find it for you. But that will come up tomorrow. Does anyone know which one it is? Which sutra is in? For the forest monk, it's... Okay, does anyone know where it is? Yeah, anyway, I'll try and find it for you tomorrow. Only try, no promises. Anyway, so I knew I shouldn't have gone over time. More work to do. It is actually in there. So anyway, so sharing merits first of all. Idam enyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam enyatina hotu sukhita hontu yatayo. Idam Ho tu sukhita hantu yatayo. Sadhu, sadhu.